policía. Mr. Bartlett, good morning to you again. Let's give everybody a chance to get in and out of the courtroom. And you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, opposing counsel, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for that. Appellant Carlos Garcia starts his case by reminding the court of the definition of robbery under 28.324, and that is with the intent to steal one forcibly or by violence, and by violence or by putting in fear, takes from the person of another any money or personal property of any value whatsoever. This court in State versus Welchel stated that an essential element of the crime of robbery be theft, and that that theft be accompanied by violence or intimidation. This court stated in State versus Adkins that a description of force and violence was the putting in fear, and a different method was force and violence, and that these two methods may be pled in the conjunctive. The Court of Appeals in State versus Rogers, which is a case from 1994, went to great lengths to discuss the minimum amount of force that's required, which brings us to the legal question for today with respect to Mr. Garcia's case, and that is, what is the minimum conduct of putting in fear that constitutes a robbery in the state of Nebraska? In this court's decision in State versus Birdhead, the court talked about force for the purpose of robbery needing to be, quote, sufficient to affect the transfer of property from the victim to the robber.
Is that what happened here?
No.
They didn't transfer the money to him?
Yes, sir. Money was transferred
in
this case.
Why did he transfer the money to him?
Bank protocol was the testimony at the time of trial.
Not that he was fear or froze or panicked?
On the state's direct examination, the principal teller, Mr. Russer, did testify that when he received the note from Mr. Garcia, he felt fear. That is in the record.
Isn't that enough?
Under the facts of this case, Mr. Garcia argues that it is not.
So and if you're a calm robber, that's okay? That's enough?
With a polite note.
Yeah, why can't we take the note at its word? The note said this is a robbery.
You can take the note at its word, and we'll try to get all this. The calm robber scenario and the taking the note at its word scenario, I would analogize it as follows. If someone other than Mr. Garcia came into a bank, let's say a minor child, and a minor child had a piece of paper written in crayon that said, this is a robbery, and handed it to Mr. Russer, Mr. Russer would say, get out of here, kid. I'm not giving you money for bubblegum. In that case, Mr. Russer, or any teller in his position, would be assessing other indicia. What do bank tellers normally assess? The presence or absence of words of violence, the presence or absence of weapons, threatening gestures, other acts that are threatening.
Let me stop you at this point, because there's something implicit in your argument, at least as I'm hearing it, I want to be sure that you're actually making. Are you differentiating a bank robbery from a convenience store robbery, or a robbery that takes place between pedestrians on a street? Is it something special about the bank that enters into this at all?
No, I'm not drawing that distinction. The Rogers case, to which I referred earlier, talks about a convenience store type of event where the defendant in question reached around the counter, bumped into the register manager, bumped him in such a way as he was reaching into the till to get money, and the Court of Appeals determined that amount of physical contact was sufficient to constitute force. I'm drawing a distinction between robbery, where a potential victim is put in fear through a defendant's action, and theft, where someone simply takes something. And I think that's what we have here when we look at the totality of Mr. Garcia's conduct. The testimony in the record, which was a combination of both what the state and defense counsel adduced, essentially characterized this event as a business transaction, not a criminal business transaction, but those folks who were observing the ongoings from that day stated and testified, when I looked over at Mr. Garcia and Teller Russer, what I thought was any normal transaction. In fact,
at Mr. Russer... At that time, had they seen the note? At the time that they made those observations, had they seen the note?
They had not seen the contents of the note. One of the witnesses said they saw some interaction of a piece of paper.
Counsel, in other jurisdictions, courts have held that under facts that are comparable, that threat or force and so forth is implicit in facts similar
That's
to
true.
This. Okay. What's
that
your response to that?
Well, my response to that is to look at the facts of this particular case when Mr. Russer is testifying that he believed that Mr. Garcia was a mute or was deaf. He didn't know what this gentleman was doing. And in effect, but for bank protocol, which was a very critical part of his testimony. His testimony was, when we are told someone is trying to take money from us, we give it to them, whether we think it should be given to them or not. And so...
Why do you suppose the bank has that protocol?
I assume they have that protocol that in the event that they're dealing with a violent individual, that violent individual doesn't hurt one of their employees.
You seem to be suggesting that some emphasis should be placed on the reaction or the observation of the other folks at the bank at the time. And I'm wondering if you would have the same position if the note here had said, give me your money, I've got a gun.
I wouldn't have the same position because that's a threatening note.
So the note is what's important and not the observations of the other folks in the room?
Well, it's the combination of those things. The note to Mr. Russer contained no threat. Mr. Russer said he interpreted it to be threat. He was essentially prompted by the state's attorney to say, do you feel that's threat? And here's why I think that's important. We're drawing a distinction between...
I'm going to interrupt you and disagree with the premise that the note contains no threat. It says this is a robbery. And to follow up on Justice Papik's question, isn't that in and of itself a threat?
I think Justice Papik's question was, isn't that in and of itself enough for a robbery? And Mr. Garcia's position is he committed a theft, not a robbery. Because a robbery, based on this court's prior jurisprudence, requires some level of force. That's the difference.
Or intimidation.
Well, and the position again here is that's why we go to the external factors, the indicia, and we say we don't have that. He walked up, he stood like this, handed a note, guy looked at it and was like, and then gave him money per bank protocol. There was no testimony, I gave him money because I was scared. I gave him money because I was intimidated. I gave him money because I thought he had a gun. In fact, the testimony was quite the opposite. He didn't ever see a weapon. He didn't see any gestures that indicated any indicia of a weapon, and neither did anyone else in the bank.
Is the standard of subjective or objective?
Well, I don't know that the court has made that determination in the context of a piece of paper. And that's the argument, and I think that's the higher level argument that we're dealing with here. If a simple note that doesn't on its face contain threatening language is enough for a robbery, then we've essentially transformed a violent offense, robbery, into a less violent offense. When we look at the jurisprudence, robbery is clearly an aggressive violent offense. That's not what happened.
Can I ask you to switch topics here a little bit on the suppression issue as it relates to the note and what is your argument, right? How that was obtained and why that's good or bad?
Well, the argument is two-tiered, and I have a minute and a half, so I'll go as quickly as I can. Number one, the note was gained as a product of an illegal detention of Mr. Garcia. The judge made a finding in her ruling on the motion to suppress that the justification for taking Mr. Garcia into custody was that the vehicle in question was a vehicle that officers have observed before, not the defendant. We don't attach a Fourth Amendment event to a vehicle, we attach it to a person. That's the basis for a crime. Second, with respect to the search that yielded the note, it is incredibly clear, unequivocal, that the search was not conducted pursuant to a lawful arrest before or after, as the state asserts in their brief, The search was, one, conducted pursuant to police policy. The officer said, anytime we put someone in an interview room, we search them, regardless of who they are or whether they're a suspect. And two, it was done as part of a locate warrant, which is a non-judicial event.
So is this your understanding of the testimony that some officer testified that with respect to an interview, in this case triggered by a locate, there's a policy to inventory?
Not a policy to inventory. That's a very critical distinction. It was a policy to check the defendant across the board. It's a general search. It wasn't to inventory the contents of his person or to determine if there were weapons. It was a general search.
Does that policy have something to do with security?
I think if the police were here, they would say yes.
Okay, so it's not a policy to inventory,
no,
according to your recollection of the testimony, but it's a policy, right, to check the contents of a person's pocket and so forth?
If we take a half step back, it's a pragmatic policy that, as the Chief Justice said, is in existence because the officers want to make sure that someone isn't walking into their space with something the person shouldn't have, whether it's a weapon or contraband or something along those lines. However, the mere fact of a policy that is triggered by a non-judicial event that allows a person to be taken into custody does not overcome the Fourth Amendment. So this was not an inventory, and the reason you know it was not an inventory is because in that section of the discussion with the officer, there is never a mention of any items being recorded, any way they're recorded, any of those documents going into the police file or to the county attorney in the case. It's just simply, we're making sure that we search people before they go in. He said, policy.
Was Mr. Garcia under arrest for driving under suspension at that time?
Well, the officer said he was, but he wasn't. And you look to the district court judge's finding, which was the basis for the justification for search incident to arrest was the officers observed the same vehicle 3 hours before. But once again, the vehicle isn't the subject of the Fourth Amendment event. It's the defendant, and the officers explicitly testified both at the suppression hearing and at the trial, we didn't know Carlos Garcia was driving.
Doesn't the record show that they saw him, Mr. Garcia, driving the vehicle, park the vehicle, and get out and run?
That's the second event.
The second event. And they know that the person they contacted running from that vehicle was the person driving that vehicle.
No,
right?
They testified that they didn't know it was the same person.
At the exact same moment, when the car pulls in and he gets out of the vehicle and runs.
You're talking about the second
the
event.
The second event.
So at the second event.
With no relation to the first event whatsoever.
Right, because they took, of course they know that's Mr. Garcia because they took him into custody.
Right. And he was driving the car at that time.
At that time, yes.
Did he have a suspended license at that time?
I don't think that was the testimony. They said that they were taking him in pursuant to the first incident. Now, it depends which part of the record you're on. If you're on the part of the record where they talk about a plate violation, which they presumed to be in effect until they approached the vehicle and determined it had in transits, that's one line of reasoning that the state gave. The second is the flight reason. They believe that he fled from them from the first incident. But then they testified they didn't know if it was him driving. And obviously that's a critical element to proving any flight charge, even the probable cause of the flight charge. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Liss, good morning to you.
Morning again. May it please the court, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. I'm going to focus on the denial of the motion to suppress, and if time permits or if the court has questions, I'll address competence and the ineffective assistance of counsel claims. I'll submit the remaining claims on brief. Just briefly before I get into the claims, I would note that I didn't handle the brief in this case. I will be expanding on the responses in our brief. As far as the denial of the motion to suppress, the appellant claims the suppression was warranted on three issues in this case: the traffic stop, the search of Garcia at the police station after he was arrested, and the search of his hotel room, which was done pursuant to the search warrant. We maintain the motion to suppress was properly denied on all three issues. As far as the validity of the traffic stop, as an initial matter, we would note that a traffic stop did not actually occur in this case, or at least no seizure occurred as a result of a traffic stop. The record reflects that they initially made the stop at approximately 1 o'clock in the morning. As they attempted to actually approach the vehicle, he fled and they did not pursue, so he didn't actually yield to authority, and thus there was no seizure. Fourth Amendment purposes, this court's decision in State v. Hill, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in California v. Hadard D.D. are instructive on that point. And then as far as the subsequent contact, about 3 hours later, when they again located Garcia's vehicle, a cruiser pulls up behind his vehicle, but they hadn't even activated their lights yet when he gets out and flees on foot. So pursuant to this court's decision of State v. Gilliam, that wasn't a seizure either. If the sole issue on this first claim is the validity of the traffic stop, we would submit there was no seizure as a result of the traffic stop and no further discussion is necessary. If this court views this claim as more of a global claim to the legitimacy of the ultimate detention, we would submit that the detention and the circumstances leading up to it were still not unlawful. The initial contact was lawful under this court's recent decision in State v. Barbeau. The subsequent contact was justified by reasonable suspicion given that Garcia fled a lawful traffic stop. So either way, whether we view this as a claim regarding purely the traffic stop or the ultimate detention, we submit this claim is without merit. As far as the search of Garcia at the police station, we maintain it was justified as a search incident to arrest. The record reflects that after he fled on foot and was apprehended, he was arrested for fleeing the scene of the traffic stop as well as driving under suspension. So we maintain that a search of Garcia and the items on his person was justified under the search incident to arrest exception. I think this court's analysis in Perry and Ranson, as well as the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in U.S. v. Robinson, are instructive there.
If the court were to view this instead as a policy pursuant to an interview on the locate, what would be your argument?
Well, even if an officer believes that's why they're doing it, or even if that is why they're doing it, the fact that you have independent justification to do so as a search incident to arrest is going to justify the search. So even for the sake of argument, if you had a problem with the policy position of the officer, the search incident to arrest exception is going to legitimize the conduct. If there are no further questions on that issue, I'll move briefly to the search of the hotel room. We disagree with the appellant's assertion that this warrant was invalid because it referred to both Garcia and Gomez. This is merely a typographical error, as the affiant officer explained. This is similar to the mistake.
Do we decide that by counting the number of times it said Gomez or Garcia, or how do we do that?
I'm sorry, how do we do what?
How do we decide whether or not which person was the intended person here? Garcia or Gomez? Do we count the number of times he was named one thing or another, or how do we settle that?
I don't think we need to count. I mean, I guess for me reading it, especially looking at context of the information in there in the body of it, that it was Garcia. I mean, it certainly says Gomez a number of times. I acknowledge that. But I think that still on its face, this is similar to the mistake that in the search warrant that this court recently dealt with in State v. Hidalgo, which this court said did not invalidate the warrant. It was an honest mistake, and the mistakes were somewhat similar and excusable. So I don't think the warrant was invalid. But in any event here, I would submit this claim as immaterial and really just a red herring, because virtually no evidence was obtained from this hotel room that was introduced at trial. When we look at the record here, the only thing that came in at trial regarding the hotel room was an officer testified. We went in there, we found an envelope, basically a venue item, an envelope with defendant's name, and a t-shirt that looked vaguely similar to that shown in the surveillance video of the robbery. But all of that was a non-issue at trial. At trial, it was undisputed that the defendant was the robbery suspect. The defense itself acknowledged that. I mean, that wasn't even the theory of the defense.
And your version is we don't need to reach that discrepancy because it won't make any difference, even if all the evidence, such as it is, from the hotel room were excluded.
Right. I mean, if the argument is that evidence from the hotel room should have been suppressed, well, effectively, none of that came in. So what's the difference? Just briefly.
Did the district court judge use that warrant to justify the search of his person?
Well, the court's order, as I read it, wasn't entirely clear on that point. The court sort of started with a search incident to arrest analysis and then said, you know, it may be that a search of that envelope wouldn't be justified alone under the search incident to arrest exception, that a warrant might be required, but we had one here. The analysis is incorrect.
Is that where the name of the individual becomes important?
I would still submit that it's immaterial because the search was justified under the search incident to arrest exception. We didn't need to resort to the warrant. The fact that the district court thought we might have, with all due respect, is incorrect. Immaterial. I don't think the warrant matters, and I don't think it otherwise comes into play here, since there's really no evidence at issue as a result of that warrant. And the appellant, as I read their brief, hasn't pointed to any, nor have they pointed to any today, that resulted from that warrant, so I just don't see why it matters unless I've missed something. Just briefly on that same note, I don't think we need to go into a harmless error, but for the sake of argument, if we would submit that really all the evidence obtained as a result or that was subject of the motion to suppress was harmless, because again, there was no dispute in this case that Garcia was the guy, that he was the robbery suspect. His ex-wife who drove him there identified him as a suspect. All the bank employees who were there who testified at trial identified him as a suspect. The defense itself acknowledged that he was a suspect. The sole theory of defense at trial was that while he was the guy, his actions wouldn't have put a reasonable person in fear, so he wasn't guilty of robbery. I mean, that was the sole issue at trial, and the state's evidence would have been just as compelling on that point, even if they had not had this evidence seized from Mr. Garcia. So, to the extent there was any error there, we would submit it was harmless. Just briefly, on the competency claim, we maintain that Mr. Garcia was properly determined to be competent. Record reflects he was evaluated prior to trial and sentencing, and at both times found to be competent. We found nothing improper or incorrect with those determinations. If the court has no questions on that, I'll move briefly to the ineffective assistance of counsel claims. I don't have much to add to our brief. I concur that the record is sufficient to reject claims 3 and 4. Would also submit that the record is sufficient to reject claim 2. Claim 2 alleges that trial counsel was ineffective for not moving for a mistrial based on Garcia's incompetence. I think this claim is without merit for the reasons just discussed. He was, in fact, competent, so there was no basis for a mistrial on that issue. Briefly on claim 3, the allegations that trial counsel failed to present a meaningful defense and more specifically should not have called Garcia to testify because this put his behavior and his alleged mental health issues on full display for the jury. This claim is without merit because all other responses aside, his trial counsel specifically advised Garcia on the record not to testify. He ultimately did so, which he had a right to do, but his trial counsel did precisely what he's alleging his trial counsel should have done, advised him not to testify. On claim 4, the speedy trial claim, I'll rest on brief unless the court has questions on that. Again, as far as sufficiency, excessive sentence, and cumulative error, I will submit those on brief as well unless the court has questions. I ask that you confirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. Mr. Bartling, were you appointed in this matter?
I was.
Thank you very much for your service. That concludes arguments for the day. The court is adjourned and you are excused.